Enjoy the small town vibe that's hiding in plain sight of Vancouver, British Columbia when you take time to visit Bowen Island.
It's across this extraordinary kind of body of water where you see orcas and obviously eagles and seals.
Work your way up the Alaska Marine Highway and then head inland to explore the great land beyond the cruise ship ports.
If you wanted a real Alaska experience, say, then you might hop into a mail plane.
And let the midnight sun surprise you on a summer hike across the backcountry of Iceland. It gave one Texan more than a few things to write home about.
The sunset is not a moment that you watch happen and then you pack it up and go back into the house. It's more something that you just see unfolding for hours.
Let's chill northern style for the hour ahead, from a cozy Canadian island to the wilds of Alaska and Iceland on Travel with Rick Steves. We're heading north for adventure in the hour ahead on today's Travel with Rick Steves. A hiking and guidebook author from Anchorage recommends exploring all of Alaska with advice on how to get there. And a creative writing instructor from Texas tells us how he had to wing it on his long-envisioned summer hike across Iceland. The isolation keeps it free of bears and mosquitoes, but not from a sense of mystery. Let's start out on a relaxed island that measures a mere 6 by 12 kilometers, where the ferry ride to Snug Cove is just a short hop from the north shore of Metro Vancouver. It's like a gem hiding in plain sight of Vancouver, BC. Bowen Island is a low-key, relaxed community 20 minutes by ferry from the Vancouver North Shore. Anthropologist and author Wade Davis has made it his home for the past few years, and he joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves to tell us about one of the coolest day trips or weekend getaways you can take from Vancouver, where traffic can't get in the way of the beauty of the British Columbia coast. Wade, thanks for joining us.
Oh, wonderful to be with you, Rick.
You have traveled all over the world. You've got so many stories in the 20-some books that you've written, ranging from Colombia to Haiti to the Amazon and Malaysia. And you call home an island just north of Vancouver City. People love Vancouver City. People love the Gulf Islands nearby. It seems like you got the best of both worlds. Describe Bowen Island.
Well, Bowen Island sits at the mouth of Howe Sound, which just by chance is adjacent to Vancouver, but it happens to be one of the most beautiful fjords on the whole coast of British Columbia. The island itself is home to, I guess, about 3,000-4,000 people. Obviously, the summer population goes up. It's a 20-minute ferry ride from Horseshoe Bay. Many people will know that ferry terminal. But it's across this extraordinary kind of body of water where you see orcas and obviously eagles and seals. And there's a sort of a wonderful sense of separation. When you get on the ferry, you just begin to relax. And because people get intimidated by the very idea of a ferry, it didn't have that kind of insane surge in real estate values that you saw in Seattle and that we certainly saw in Vancouver. And so you have a kind of mixed community on Bowen. You know, you have people from all walks of life, but it's got a real old-time kind of wonderful Canadian community sense. And of course, it's got a lot of artists and writers and musicians and people who can afford not to go into the city, you know, 5 days a week and work from home.
So Wade, when you think about Bowen Island, Lonely Planet's guidebook calls it the best day trip from Vancouver. If you wanted to visit Bowen Island, would you actually sleep there? Would you camp there? Or would you make it a day trip from Vancouver? What would you recommend?
I think you can do so many different things. It's got 13 beaches. It's got the trail system across the heights of the highest point, which is Mount Gardner, with incredible vistas south toward the university, west towards Vancouver Island, and of course, north up Howe Sound itself. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful lake, Killarney Lake, right at the foot of where we live, which has to be one of the most beautiful hour, an hour and a half walks to be found in the lower mainland of British Columbia. And of course, you can, in Snug Cove, you can rent kayaks. There are wonderful pubs and spots, wonderful shops with art. You know, there's a lot of artists on the island. And people are very friendly. And I'll tell you, there's a kind of a sense that we're all in this together that I really, really find really endearing about being in Canada. And I think this is part of the matrix that makes Canada really work.
University of British Columbia anthropologist Wade Davis is joining us from his home on Bowen Island on Travel with Rick Steves. It's a 6 by 12 kilometer island with a relaxed Pacific Northwest atmosphere. It even has seasonal water taxi service from the heart of Vancouver.
Wade, isn't the Sunshine Coast just a little farther north from there?
If you go up Howe Sound, Rick, of course, you eventually get Squamish, which is just exploding. It's become like the desirable place for all young outdoor Canadians. It's an incredible community. And of course, north of there, you get the great resort of Whistler and eventually Pemberton. And then you can cross over the mountains to Lillooet in the Fraser Valley. And then if you take the ferry to Gibson's, you end up in the Sunshine Coast, which is another
ferry. That ferry is just a treat. And then you drive up and you get to literally the end of the road at Lund, which is a great jumping off point for Desolation Sound and some amazing natural wonders up there.
You know, we're all blessed in the Pacific Northwest, Rick. You know, I mean, one of the things I find it's worth remembering is that, you know, until the building of the Panama Canal, this was about as far from Europe as you can get. So at a time when the Amazon had been explored for 400 years and Montreal, for example, was entering a third or fourth century, Europeans hadn't even reached this coast. So one of the things that's really wonderful is the dynamic presence of the First Nations.
Now, this is something I wanted to talk to you about because the University of British Columbia, where you're a professor, has a prominent museum of anthropology, and you're a professor of anthropology. And every time I go to Canada, I'm impressed, I'm inspired by the respect Canadians give their Indigenous peoples. What's your take on that, and what can Americans learn from this?
Well, I mean, obviously, Canada has not always been kind to the First Nations. We have a very dark history of the residential schools, as did the United States, the Americanization of the American Indian. But there are a couple of big differences between the States and Canada that's no one's fault. You know, America primarily was a settler society. I mean, people came over from England to practice religious freedom or their own brand of religious intolerance, but they were there to stay. And Canada, in its genesis, was a mercantile society of fur traders. And our entire economy for 250 years was based on a fashion statement, the beaver hat. and so we didn't set out to slaughter Indigenous people, as indeed did happen in the States. We often married them and married up in the world by doing so. And that doesn't mean we've been kind, but there's been certainly recently a tremendous effort at reconciliation, a national catharsis, as we've tried to come to terms with our past in a really, I think, imperfect and lots more to do, but really admirable way. I mean, if you think about it, we have one of the quirks of Canadian history is that the British North America Act and then the Royal Proclamation of 1763 said that all First Nations had to be treated with. And by the time the frontier reached the Rockies, the collapse due to disease was such that the colonial fathers didn't bother to treat with all these powerful societies of the Northwest. And so we now, by every definition of British law, they own the land and we have to treat with them about that. And it's a very complicated, very expensive process, but fundamentally, the entire country is behind this gesture of restitution, reconciliation.
So does that mean that your Indigenous population is in a better socioeconomic sort of situation than America's?
No. I mean, yes and no. We've got dozens and dozens of First Nations in British Columbia. Some have really gone through an extraordinary renaissance, like the Haida, for example. And I would say that in general, in British Columbia, the situation of First Nations is better than in the United States. But we still have shameful statistics. I mean, in the same way.
Statistically, Indigenous people are usually the bottom rung of the economic ladder.
Well, I think a bigger indication of Canadian shame would be prison populations. And in the same way that it's shameful in the United States, the inordinate percentage of African Americans, given their percentage of the population, we would have something of the same shame in our prisons in Canada. So this is not to say that we don't have a long way to go. But on the other hand, you know, some time ago, we created the new territory of Nunavut, an area half the size of Western Europe, and gave total administrative control to 26,000 Inuit people who really do control their own destiny economically, politically, socially, culturally.
Is that the Northwest Territories?
It was the Northwest Territories.
So now it has a new name.
Nunavut, yeah. It's a new homeland. And of course, the Inuit are now dealing with something beyond their capacity to adapt to, and that is climate change, where the world is literally melting out from beneath them.
Well, it's a huge issue if your buildings are all sitting on frozen tundra, right?
Right, of course. It's a bigger problem if your entire consciousness and spirit is honed by the ice.
So we've progressed far beyond beaver hats these days, and with all of the well-meaning approach that Canadians have to First Nations people, what can we learn from Indigenous culture? What has Canada learned that has changed their outlook and gave them an appreciation of a different way to look at life and a different way to look at the world?
Well, I think the overall tolerance and the quest for not to be a melting pot, but to be a mosaic, as we say in Canada, a world of differences, a pluralistic society in which every voice is heard and each is seen to be deserving of an audience. You know, one of the incredible things about Canada is the way that we've dealt with immigration. Cities like Toronto, half the people in Toronto are born outside of Canada. Let me give you one concrete example. All of our fruit in Ontario is picked by Mexican labor, just like yours is, right? But we have a very different system. What happens in Canada is a Mexican laborer sometimes actually has their flight subsidized by the government. They arrive, the minute they arrive, they get universal health care, proper union conditions. And if they overstay their welcome, their visa, by one day they'll never come back. But we don't act on the assumption that they're trying to get in. What person from Guadalajara would want to deal with an Ontario winter? We assume they want to go home, build better houses, flaunt their wealth, and that's what they do. And so as a result of that, we have almost zero challenges on that front because the labor force comes in and it goes back and it comes back again. And I didn't even know about this until I was told by our Canadian ambassador in Mexico City. So again, that dynamic, localized as it may be in Ontario, generates a huge amount of goodwill between the Canadian people and the Mexican people.
Mm, I wish we would splice that into our discussion when it comes to spending billions of dollars on a wall to keep people that want to come into our country and work out.
I know. Yeah, I always think that wall is an act of treason because you're betraying the essence and the beauty of the country. You know, the huddled masses, that's the foundational myth. And myths aren't old stories, they're moral charters. And if you betray that, you're betraying something of yourself.
Wade Davis, I'm so thankful we have people that we see as brothers and sisters north of our border who can give us a little tough love once in a while when it comes to grappling with challenges that both of our societies are facing. And thank you so much for joining us today. Best wishes with your work as a professor at UBC and with your writing, especially with your books. I'm just loving your book, Magdalena, River of Dreams, The Story of Columbia, as well as other thoughtful books you've written over the years. Take care, Wade.
Thanks, Rick.
Anthropology professor Wade Davis writes about exploring the mighty river that defines the nation of Colombia in his book, Magdalena, River of Dreams. You can also hear that in the Travel with Rick Steves archives. There's more on his writings and documentary video projects from around the world on his website, daviswade.com. The Alaska cruise ships sail right past Bowen Island as they aim for the Inside Passage. But we'll take you beyond the usual cruise ports of Alaska next. And then we head for Iceland. It's Travel with Rick Steves. When Alaskans talk about going outside, they typically mean any place beyond the state's border. But when those of us in the lower 48 want to get outside, and there's probably no better or definitely no bigger outside in the entire United States than Alaska. It might be one of those reasons we're called outsiders by the locals. One such local is Lisa Maloney. She's the author of The Moon Guide to Alaska, and she's lived in Anchorage now for over 30 years, and that's long enough to be considered an insider. Most visitors these days experience Alaska on a cruise ship, skimming the ports of its spectacular southeast panhandle, but barely touching the rest of the coastline or the vast interior. So what I want to do right now is spend a few minutes with Lisa Maloney, and I want to get beyond the cruise ports. For that, we're going to need Lisa's help. Lisa, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You know, you've apparently fell in love with Alaska when your parents, I understand, dragged you there kicking and screaming as a kid. 30 years later, you're still there. What is it about Alaska?
This is true. I think it is the fact that when you leave an Alaska town, you're out of town. Capital O, capital O, capital T. You are now out of the city, and you can tell there are dozens or often hundreds of miles of trees or mountains between you and the next place. So the fact that even living in Alaska's biggest city as I do, I'm really only a short drive from true wilderness. You know, I wasn't born with a connection to that, but gosh, it sure got a hold of me once we moved up here, and I can't imagine being without it.
Well, you're not alone, because in your book you quote John Muir, and he said, you shouldn't go to Alaska because once you do, you'll never be satisfied with anywhere else for the rest of your life. Can you relate to that?
I can absolutely relate to that. I will say maybe it's a little different for other people, you know, depending on how much you prioritize being close to family and friends. It's actually a big deal. It can feel a little isolating up here. But for me, the wilderness and the real world, which is what I think of the natural world as, that's what wins out over everything else.
Well, yes, for sure, the real world. Now, most of us experience Alaska, as I mentioned, on a cruise ship. And that's, you know, a great way to travel if you want to just see the wonders from the deck of this big ship with 1,000 or 3,000 other people. I'm fascinated by the sort of the backstory of how the cruise industry works. I would imagine most of the cruise action is in the Southeast, and the cruise ship has to negotiate with a town to dock there and to let its people out and buy stuff and everything. And some towns play ball with the cruise industry and some towns decide not to. I suppose it's a mixed bag. If you're a Skagway, do you really want your economy dominated by the cruise industry? As an Alaskan resident, what do you think the pros and cons are for that a town has to discuss before they open the door to the cruise industry?
Sure. So just to be upfront, cruise ships very, very rarely stop in Anchorage. So I'm more relaying what I've heard and seen while visiting ports where there is a lot of cruise activity. The upside is getting a lot of bodies delivered straight to you. The downside, I think, is that those bodies don't always stay in town, or they might be funneled into activities, because when you're on a cruise ship, one of the most important things is not to miss the ship, right? So a lot of cruise passengers naturally gravitate toward activities that promise to get them back on time, or if they take an excursion that is run by the cruise ship or in partnership with the cruise ship. And if you're late while on that excursion, the ship will actually wait for you, as opposed to if you go off on your own devices and maybe book an independent excursion. If there's a delay, let's say you're on a boat tour and the boat's engine dies out, then if you miss your boat, the boat's not going to wait for you because you weren't on their trip, not their business. Yeah. And you'll have to catch up to them later. So because of that, I think it's pretty natural that cruise ship passengers tend to get funneled into these excursions that might actually be run by the cruise ship company as opposed to the locals.
It's a big part of their profit. I mean, a lot of times you can marvel at how cheap a cruise is before you factor in how much you're going to spend on the excursions.
Right. So there's a question of how much, as a cruise passenger, how much of your money that you're spending seemingly locally, the big question there is how much of that is actually going into the local economy. Another thing that happens in some cruise ports, or I've seen it in quite a few of them up here, and I know it's a real bone of contention within the communities, is that once you're established as a big ship cruise port, then people start coming in from out of town or out of state or maybe even out of country and setting up during the summers, during the active cruise season, to run a shop selling things to visitors who come on the cruise ships. And then they leave at the end of the year. So again, that is more money that the visitors think they are spending locally and supporting local businesses, but that's not actually the effect.
We're exploring Alaska beyond the cruise ports right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Our guest is travel writer and hiking enthusiast Lisa Maloney. She writes The Moon Guide to Alaska, which has been her home for the last 30 years. Lisa is also the author of Day Hiking South Central Alaska and 50 Hikes Around Anchorage. Her website is hikingalaska.net, or you can find her on social media platforms under the handle @hikingalaska. We know that we can have it all on a platter when we take a cruise, and most people go to Alaska and enjoy that, and for most people it probably makes perfect sense. If you're a little more independent and you want to do Alaska without the cruise industry, it's fun to think of the regions and what they have to offer. In your book, you lay out 5 regions, 3 in the south, the far north, and then the interior, the Denali National Park, essentially. Let's talk about each of those regions. First of all, the most famous that we all would see if we took a cruise is Juneau in the southeast, right?
Absolutely. And I consider Juneau sort of the epicenter of that, in part because they do host an awful lot of cruise ships, but also because they're a very easy port to fly into. So if you wanted to see Southeast Alaska, flying there by jet going to Juneau is one of the easiest ways to start your journey. Once you're there, you can still get around by boat, but it doesn't have to be a cruise ship. One of my favorite ways to explore Southeast Alaska is on the Alaska State Ferry, which is technically known as the Alaska Marine Highway System. Kind of a cool little factoid. It is actually considered a federal highway simply because it provides such essential services and connections to a lot of communities that are on islands. So, you know, you can't drive there, and sometimes you can't even take a big plane to get there. So a boat is the best way to go.
And you can essentially camp out on that ferry and enjoy sort of a poor man's cruise.
You can literally camp out on the ferry. It is absolutely one of my favorite things to do. They have these solariums, or any of the ferries that take a journey of more than a few hours long usually have these. They are like an open air covered area on the top deck of the ship, but they have heat lamps. So even if it's a kind of a crisp day, you're usually not too cold. And if you're at the front of the line when you get on the ferry, you can kind of hustle up there. You have to beat the crowds because lots of other people want to do it too. Uh-huh. You take your sleeping bag and you get yourself either a patch of floor space or one of the plastic loungers that they have up there. Ah. And you can just camp.
The second region that you mention in your book, Lisa, is Anchorage and South Central. It's interesting to me, there's three regions along the south, and that is where the lion's share of the visitors go. So we just talked about Juneau in the southeast. Next would be Anchorage and South Central before we get to the big arm that sticks out with the Aleutian Islands and so on, right? So tell us a little bit about Anchorage and the South Central region.
Sure. So Anchorage is my home stomping grounds. I've lived here for more than 30 years. And I'd say one of the most remarkable things about it is that you can drive lots of places from here. The road system in Alaska does not cover the entire state. It's really focused here in South Central and then up into the interior around Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. So just the fact of having so many scenic drives makes South Central pretty special. We're also at the nexus of land and sea to a certain degree. So there are places where you can hop on a day cruise, for example, to go see tidewater glaciers calving into the ocean. And then you can also go for a wonderful hike. And again, more to the point, you can drive between those two things. You can drive between your day cruise port and wherever you're going for a hike.
And you could drive 4 hours or so to Denali National Park and see a mountain that's 5,000 feet taller than Mount Rainier.
You absolutely can. And actually, one of the most amazing things about Denali is that the best place to see it is not necessarily in Denali National Park, although you can get some amazing views there, but you can get some spectacular views from just 2 or 3 hours north of Anchorage, right off the road.
Nice. And by the way, for the old timers here who think about Mount McKinley, that's now called Denali out of respect to the Native Alaskans, right?
Yes. So I would say that locally it has always been known as Denali, but it is now recognized federally as Denali as well.
Ah, okay. Lisa Maloney is offering us an insider's guide to Alaska beyond the cruise ship ports right now on Travel with Rick Steves. She's a longtime resident of Anchorage, a hiking enthusiast and guide, and the author of The Moon Guidebook to Alaska. The next region I'd like you to explain a little bit is that southwest, what you call the arm with Kodiak.
So I would say starting from Kodiak, you know, I've never actually picked too many brains about whether Kodiak would be considered part of South Central or part of Southwest Alaska. But the fact that it is an island, and it just ties so well into that region because you'll see a lot of similarities between, say, Kodiak and going on down the Aleutian Islands. These are all big fishing ports.
Yeah, Bristol Bay, I just think of like industrial strength, massive fishing, Bristol Bay.
Absolutely. And the Bering Sea that is, you know, you can't really see it, but I always joke that I carry a map of Alaska around on my arm with me. Because if you curl your bottom three fingers in and you leave your index finger sticking out and your thumb sticking out, and then you turn your hand so those two fingers are at the bottom, if you do it with your right hand,
I was doing it with my left hand, so now I got to arc it all the way around.
Okay, yeah. If you do it with your right hand or with your left hand and imagine you're looking in a mirror, and if you're looking at the back of your hand, then that looks like a map of Alaska. And yeah. So the Aleutian Islands would be your index finger, that sort of long sweep of islands. And up above them is the Bering Sea. And that yeah. also is...
So my middle finger knuckle is Nome.
Just about, yeah. But so that whole sweep going down your index finger, or more appropriately, the Aleutian Islands, you have these relatively isolated and remote communities where fishing is usually a big part of the lifestyle. Kodiak fits in with that, absolutely. Crabbing is a huge industry in Kodiak and fishing in general. The Aleutians would be mostly treeless, and they would also be bearless, which is kind of exciting for people who might be concerned about having outdoor adventures in bear land. Kodiak, of course, does have bears. They have the largest subspecies of bear in the world, I believe, the Kodiak brown bear. But still, there's just a lot of similarity, so it makes sense to tie Kodiak in there.
And then the middle of your hand, going back to your hand map, would be the Denali National Park, which is a vast natural wonderland. But let's just finish off talking with the Arctic.
So, up at the very top of your hand, in the Arctic, we've done away with roads for the most part. So we're back to having to fly to most places. There might be river access between some communities, but those are not places that visitors would usually go. And one of the biggest communities to visit in the Arctic is Utqiagvik. And I'm just going to apologize if I'm not saying that perfectly, but I think I'm pretty close. Mm-hmm. Some listeners might be more used to hearing that described as Barrow, because that was the name, but the community voted to adopt a more traditional name for it, thus Utqiagvik. It is a remarkable place that you absolutely must visit at least once in your life just to see what life is like there, because it's very different than what you or I might expect in some ways.
Now, how so? Because in your book, you talk about deep indigenous traditions. Is that part of that, what you're talking about, so different?
Absolutely. So, for example, I have not had this experience myself because I've never been in town at exactly the right time. But I have spoken to people who've gone up there when whaling was happening, and they actually got to help pull a whale in. Because if a whaling crew actually catches a whale, it's all hands on deck,
it's
the entire
big news
community.
In the town formerly known as Barrow.
It's huge news, and it's also a huge animal, so people actually turn out to pull it in. So Utqiagvik is also one of the few places where you might be able to see polar bears, which I know is a big, exciting item for people. They are usually not wandering through town. It can happen, but the community actually goes to pains to make sure that doesn't happen as much as possible.
When you think of going way up into the north, where you've got this rich culture and this powerful natural opportunities, it involves flying. Local people fly around Alaska like we catch a bus, it seems like. Mm-hmm. What's it like for a tourist to fly around Alaska?
If you're going somewhere like Nome or Utqiagvik or even Kodiak, then you can actually fly there in a 737. So the experience is not going to be that different. But if you wanted a real Alaska experience, say, then you might hop into a mail plane that happens in a few places. We're talking postal mail, not male or female. Mm. And those are small planes that can be anywhere from 1 to 8 passengers that bop around the smaller communities that you absolutely cannot reach by road. And that is how they get their mail. The plane flies up, drops it off, and then takes off again.
And if you're just talking in very, very general terms, would you say $100 per hop, whether you're going on a bigger plane or a little plane, or how much if you just want to fly from town to town in Alaska where there are no roads?
You know, the smaller planes are, interestingly enough, much more expensive than the bigger planes. And at the same time, if you are flying in a bigger plane, say a 737 around Alaska, that tends to be more expensive than a longer flight down to Seattle.
Oh, really?
For
example. It's quite costly to hop from town to town then. You'd be, if you're on a budget, you'd be better off going in and around Anchorage with a tour or with a train or with a car.
It's much easier, yes. And accommodations tend to be more expensive in the smaller communities, too. Mm. Yeah. One thing that might be important for visitors to keep in mind also is that in the very, very small communities, sometimes there isn't a single hotel and there are really no visitor accommodations. So those are the types of places that you wouldn't go unless you're invited, simply because there's not going to be anywhere for you to sleep unless you're sleeping on a, you know, the gymnasium floor in the school. But you'd have to, you don't just drop in and say, hi, can I sleep in your gym? They need to invite you in to do that.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Lisa Maloney. She writes the Moon Guidebook to Alaska. So Lisa, you know, we've been talking about enjoying Alaska beyond the cruise ships. If you had a friend who's going to Alaska and they want to experience it beyond the cruise ships, what's your best single piece of advice?
To accept that you probably will not be able to see the entire state. So instead, just because of the sheer size of it and the logistical challenge sometimes of getting from one place to the other, instead of trying to see the entire state and then feeling sort of sad and disappointed that you spent all your time running around and no time actually seeing anything, pick a region that appeals to you. Pick maybe two or three of the activities or experiences that you most want to have. Then dial in which region is going to give you the best chance of doing those things. And plan to spend some time there. If you have more than, say, 2 weeks, then pick a second region and go there too. But you can really occupy yourself for a week or two in one single region and still feel like you've only scratched the surface.
Nice. Lisa Maloney, thanks so much for joining us and best wishes with your work, sharing your expertise on Alaska with all the people who dream of visiting.
Thank you so much, Rick. It was a pleasure to be here.
Lisa Maloney tells us about the thrills of getting outdoors into the Alaska winter in a Travel with Rick Steves interview from December 2023. You can hear it from our show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. A creative writing professor from Texas takes us along on his summer hike in Iceland, into an environment that, apart from lots of open space, is the polar opposite from his home in Lubbock. That's next. Kurt Caswell is a professor of writing and literature at Texas Tech University, and one day he decided to venture far from Texas, to the end of the world. And if any place feels like the end of the world, it's gotta be Iceland. That's where he spent much of a summer, backpacking and researching the Icelandic language. And because he's a professor of creative writing and literature, that experience eventually turned into a book. It's called Iceland Summer, Tales Along the Ring Road. And he's joining us today from Lubbock, Texas, to talk about his experiences traversing Iceland by foot. Kurt, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Wow, what a great combo. A literature professor exploring Iceland's most remote corners and packing along both a fascination with Icelandic sagas from the Viking times and a notebook. You must have been in hog heaven as a creative writer.
Yeah, that trip going to Iceland, I imagined that for a number of years before I got there, and it was really one of the most spectacular and heroic landscapes I've ever been in.
Now, Kurt, you hiked and took buses all around the Ring Road. That's an 800-mile circular road around the entire island of Iceland. Tell us, you started out envisioning a long hike from town to town, but then the reality disappointed you and you ended up mixing it between bus rides and hikes. What was the deal?
Yeah, Scott and I, my walking partner, we decided that walking along those highways would be a bit of a drag. And it became much more compelling to us to get out into the backcountry on foot, you know, mm-hmm. and so we ended up deciding to bus from town to town and then make a trip into the backcountry instead.
And I've been on that road enough to know that it's a nice drive, but you wouldn't really want to walk it. What you want to do is get off the road.
Exactly.
Now, how did you navigate? Because you were dropped on the north tip of Iceland, 8 miles from where you're going to be sleeping, at 4 p.m., and you've been hiking into the wilderness. You could get turned around quite easily. I mean, it's just a vast, mossy lava, sort of otherworldly moonscape.
Absolutely. We had two forms of navigation. Well, we had good planning, for one thing, but we also had a handheld GPS. Mm-hmm. But there's also a system of cairns that have been constructed along some of those trails. Mm-hmm. So places in which you're walking through a rocky, you know, a rock field where you don't really see a trail, you can see these distant rock towers, and you go from rock tower to rock tower.
So that's what I envision from reading your chapter on that, is just you're looking at these 5-foot-tall cairns, and you walk to one, and then it's a, you know, a landscape is flat enough where you can see the next one, and you go to that, and you did that for 8 miles, and you started when most people would be wrapping up. You started at 4 p.m., but of course, this is the land of the midnight sun. Tell us about your, what is it like to hike in a country with the midnight sun?
Well, having grown up, you know, in a Forest Service family with a father who took me out into the wild routinely and instructed me very well that you always get up early and travel early in the morning because you will need daylight, right, in case you have a problem. It was pretty counterintuitive for me to think that, oh yeah, we can start our walk today in the afternoon and it doesn't really matter how late we walk. So we just walked, you know, until almost midnight on that first day and felt like it was daylight.
And you called it a cold, windy, weird twilight that lasted all night. And, you know, when I'm filming, twilight is like magic hour. That's when you've got just a little window of time when the light is just really, really cool. But you could have, quote, magic hour going for a long, long time. And you're marveling at the way the sun does not actually set. What does it do?
So the sun seems to be not setting, but sitting on the edge of the horizon, just kind of hanging out there and moving along it. So you get this ethereal light that comes straight at you as if it's skipping like a stone over the water.
And it's not a moment. It's the whole part of the day.
Exactly. It doesn't, the sunset is not a moment that you watch happen and then you pack it up and go back into the house. It's more something that you just see unfolding for hours.
It almost frees you to be in that twilight magic moment in a way that's not fleeting.
And, you know, I think it's one of the sources, at least in my imagining, for this great wealth of stories about trolls and elves and the hidden people in Iceland, because so much of the summer exists at that, as you said, the magic hour, where, you know, your vision is not just, it's just not quite as acute as it is during midday.
Yes, it's just ripe for adventure. I mean, you wrote, if I was a troll, I would do my dirty deeds at twilight. But I mean, if you know the trolls, if you know the sagas and the legends that happen in northern regions, I guess you could probably compare legends and mythology from different Nordic peoples, because they all have that rich twilight to stir up their misadventures.
Well, one of the hallmarks of the trolls' activity is to attack and maybe try to destroy, throw rocks at churches, because there's this antagonism between, you know, those old pagan cultural norms and then the new cultural norm, which is Christianity. So there's a give and take there.
It gives you a fertile area for creating stories and adventures.
Absolutely.
We're trading travel tales of Iceland right now on Travel with Rick Steves with Kurt Caswell. Kurt teaches creative writing at Texas Tech. He received a humanities grant to study the historic Icelandic literature known as the sagas, written in the 13th and 14th centuries. Kurt stayed for the summer to explore some of Iceland's backcountry, off the road that encircles the wild beauty of the island. He writes about it in his book, Iceland Summer. So let's take us just to the interior. I mean, I love the map that you have in your book because it shows all the different places you explored. Paint a picture of what it's like. I was just fascinated by the mossy lava fields. It was like walking on a mattress.
Yeah, so making that trip around the ring road, there were a number of points where I thought I needed to stay to get out into the east along this lake where there's supposedly a Loch Ness-type monster, to get into the south, looking up at that great glacier that looms over the southern coast. And then when you go into the interior, it's a much more barren and rocky landscape. And it is traditionally the hideout of thieves and criminals. And a great number of the stories come out of that center of the island.
There's a vastness of Iceland that's a function really of the population sparsity. They say you can see half of the people on the entire island from the top of the church spire in the capital city of Reykjavik. Once you get out of the capital, you can hike for hours and not see a soul.
That's right. But it is the kind of country that I think you don't want to stay in a vehicle or in a bus or there are no train systems, but you want to really get out and look around on foot.
And even if you are road tripping, because it's sort of an epic road trip, the Ring Road, it takes about a week to go around that 800-mile. There's just one highway. It's Highway 1. Can't get lost. And a big decision is, do we go clockwise or counterclockwise? But after that, your route is done. But there's plenty of trailheads, and there's plenty of little lanes that you can venture off. And at every little dirt lane that goes off the road, there's a metal information post that has a schematic map, and it shows you in sort of a chart what is out there. Where is the bed and breakfast or the farm or the waterfall, and what is the history of that little church and so on. I just thought it was so accessible. Tell us just a little bit about venturing. What do you stumble upon as you're exploring the vast, unpopulated, far reaches of Iceland?
Well, I think you stumble upon yourself. Physically, you know, when you're encountering a landscape that is so different from maybe the one you come from, the discovery that's there waiting for you is a little microcosm for your life that touches you.
You talked about that in your book, where you and your partner were just sitting at the edge of a lake for like 3 hours, you know, watching for the monster. But you mentioned this is really part of travel, is to take a moment and just be in a place.
Yeah, I think that is the essence of travel, is not to necessarily just go to see the big highlights that, you know, you have listed out of a guidebook or something, or jump on a bunch of organized tours. And often the most delightful moments on a journey come at the most surprising moments, such as when you're sitting on a lake, essentially doing nothing.
You talked about that also when you're in Hornstrandir. That's like the closest part of Iceland to Greenland, only accessible by boat, apparently, and just super remote feeling. You said it was like the world of Beowulf and Grendel going back in time.
So yeah, I studied Beowulf and read it as a child, and that landscape is the typical hero's journey for me. And Iceland, I had read, feels like the landscape of Beowulf. So I sought out Iceland specifically for that reason.
You know, that takes us way back to the, you know, centuries ago into the dark depths of the Middle Ages. It reminds me of 1,000 years ago when Eric the Red and those first Viking settlers landed. It was an uninhabited island, wasn't it? And if you find yourself in a remote perch, the view you see could be exactly what those first settlers saw.
You know, one of the interesting things about Iceland's story is that it was uninhabited when Norse people started to arrive there, except there apparently were some Irish monks who had sort of encamped there briefly. So you're right, they had an island there that was completely empty, maybe even inviting them to stay.
You know, I remember you even wrote that the only animals there were the Arctic foxes that were indigenous to the island.
Correct. Only mammals, or only land mammal.
Okay. Right? The only land indigenous. Mammals was foxes. Yeah. Tell me about the animals that we think of today when we think of Iceland. They must have been brought by the settlers, the horses and the sheep and so on.
Yeah. The horses, the sheep. There's even some caribou and also, you know, other sorts of animals like mice and rats that came off of ships. Those all inhabited Iceland.
It's an amazing story. And the horses are just delightful. And the thought is, these are purebred horses. They were brought over 1,000 years ago. They never were exposed to other diseases or what it's like to be out and about. So they were kind of fragile, and they had to protect them from other horses coming in. So they've had a law for centuries where the horses, once they left, could not come back, and no other horses could be brought in. And it's just this remarkably purebred horse that is small but really hardy, right?
Yeah, and you see them quite frequently along roadsides, and you know, to see a fence line on a roadside as you're walking along and have a bunch of those Icelandic horses approach you is a pretty sweet moment.
Backlit by a setting sun with the wind ruffling their mane. It's so beautiful. Kurt Caswell is traveling with us in Iceland right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Kurt leads intensive field writing workshops in creative writing with the Honors College at Texas Tech. He writes about his adventures in Iceland in his book, Iceland Summer: Travels Along the Ring Road. Kurt also writes about the first Soviet space dog in his earlier book, Laika's Window. His website is kurtcaswell.com, and that's Kurt with a K and Caswell with a C. Kurt, I love when you talked about trekking to Dettifoss. Iceland has these amazing waterfalls, and apparently Dettifoss is the most powerful waterfall in all of Europe. And you chose not to drive there, but to actually hike in sort of through the back door. Tell us why and what that was like.
Well, we'd been hiking a number of backcountry trails, and it just made sense to approach that waterfall in all its power and fury even from the trail rather than the road. In fact, it was quite a surprise when we walked in and we come off the trail after a couple of days of slogging through the rain and walking along this amazing river corridor, looking down into this torrent, you know, in this dark canyon, and pop out into a parking lot with buses and people filing off in their dress shoes. And, you know, that's a strange feeling, but the more the merrier, I suppose.
But you were glad you did it. You were glad you earned the view.
Yes, yes. We felt like we'd earned the view.
Yeah. You know, when I'm immersed in nature, and you're certainly immersed in the power as well as the fragility of nature when you're in Iceland, I think a lot about climate change. Did you get many times when you were more aware of climate change, or did your ideas about climate change, were they impacted by your experience in Iceland in any way?
It's not that while traveling in Iceland, I saw evidence, you know, direct evidence of climate change so much, but we went into this museum, really, which is called the Library of Water, and there's a representation of water captured from each of the major glaciers in Iceland in these columns. And you walk through these columns as if they're, you know, trees, and they're all illuminated with a light bulb in the floor. I walk up to one of them, and the light bulb had gone out. It was the only column that wasn't illuminated. So I went up to the person at the desk, and I asked her why that light bulb was out. And she said, you know, that's the first major glacier in Iceland that has now been declared gone. And she talked to the artist and said, hey, the light went out in that column, and we should replace the bulb. And she and the artist decided, let's leave the light bulb dark. So there was this, you know, artistic representation of what could happen and what will happen. And you imagine 10 years from now, 20 years from now, if the Library of Water is still there, that maybe light bulbs in many of those columns will be dim, and you'll be able to see there, you know, manifest what's happening in a place like Iceland as the earth warms.
And the day will come when there'll be no more ice in Iceland.
Yeah, yeah.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Kurt Caswell. His book is Iceland Summer, Travels Along the Ring Road. Kurt, I'd like to just finish with a thought from you as a professor. You come back from this experience to West Texas and at Texas Tech, and you're teaching your students about creative writing. How do you employ what you learned, and what's your trick now that, how are you a better teacher back in the classroom in West Texas?
You have to get those students out into the landscape if they're going to write about place or they're going to write about journeys. So if you ask students to write about a journey, they'll try to reach back into, you know, their memory. And those experiences just are not very vibrant. They're dimmed by time. But if they tell them they have to go on a 3-hour walk over the weekend and then bring that back as the center of their story, that writing becomes much richer and more vibrant.
You know, that is so much my experience also. I remember going to Europe once I was going to go to Europe without a tour to lead, without a guidebook to write, without a TV show to make. I just went there to remember things I had done and write a story about it. And I thought it'd be better in Europe to do that in Europe. And I got over there and it was really depressing. Everything I wrote from ages before was flat. And then I realized, wait a minute, I should be writing about what I'm experiencing now, even though it wasn't as epic. It was just much more vivid, wasn't it? So I suppose part of that is take a notebook with you and be in the moment with your writing.
Absolutely. Something happens, you know, when you're out on a journey and you're keeping notes and you're documenting daily what's happening to you. And just the act of doing that, whether you publish something or not, allows you to, I think, see more clearly and pay better attention, you know, to the journey itself. You're not just going and spending money and eating in restaurants and, you know, flying home.
share just a moment of observation where you were in the middle of nowhere hiking and you were glad you had your notebook ready to go.
So when we were on that trip in the Hornstrander, we reached a moment on the third day where we felt lost in the landscape. And I could see this cairn emerging through the mist because it was a very overcast day and there was this rain coming in. So in this strange landscape, I stopped and made some notes and even a sketch of what that landscape looked like so that I could remember it because it seemed like such a poignant moment.
Mm. Kirk Caswell, thanks so much for joining us and best wishes with your teaching and future travels.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton, Kazmira Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Quirt. Jerry Frank wrote and performed our theme music. You can find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Monday Night Travel. It's a weekly travel party, and you're invited. Zoom in and have some fun learning about Europe's art, history, culture, and food over drinks and snacks. It's free, it's an adventure, and be careful, it can be addictive. Join me and my travel buddies over Zoom for Monday Night Travel. We're live every week, starting at 6 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 p.m. Eastern. Register at ricksteves.com and BYOB.